Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome back. The topic for this year will be modern Jewish denominations. We're going to study the origins and development of the various religious denominations that exist in Judaism. Our focus will be primarily on developments in Central Europe and in the United States. So basically Germany, Austria, Hungary, to a lesser extent England, and then America. Beginning in the early part of the 19th century and extending as far as we can go into the 20th century. Hopefully we'll get to the second half of the 20th century. Tonight, we'll do the precursor, which is to say that religious denominations only develop as an alternative to the old-fashioned tradition when there is a sufficient, there's a critical mass of people who desire a style of Judaism that is other than what they were originally accustomed to. And invariably, at least in modern times, it's going to be a watering down of the religious commitment. So as opposed to religious denominations that existed in, let's say, Second Temple times or the early rabbinic period, where the heterodox group is just as frum in their own minds as the so-called orthodox group, let's say the Sadducee-Pharisee divide or the Rabbinite and Karaite divide, each one is sincerely approaching the totality of tradition as they believe it is correctly interpreted. In modern times, it will be sort of a walking away from some of tradition that is no longer perceived as relevant to the modern experience. That's going to be the focus of, at least in the early reform phase, how much of tradition should be preserved in light of current circumstances. Okay, but this can only happen in certain parts of the world where there is acculturation, where people are aware of the surrounding environment that is the non-Jewish surrounding environment, and where their political situation is not just that of the old ghetto, but rather is evolving towards citizenship in a free society. Okay. So, where does reform get off the ground? Mostly in Germany in its earliest phases. So, they look for precedent. What kind of precedent can they have for a style of Judaism that is ever-evolving and not as demanding as an older form? So Samuel Holdheim, who we'll speak about much more in about 4 weeks from now, who was the chief ideologue of radical reform, he would say that we can turn to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, that when things change for Am Yisrael, for the Jewish people, in a dramatic fashion, like, for example, the destruction of the temple, so Judaism as a religion will also have to change, given the new circumstances. And so post-temple Judaism, that of the school of Yavne, and of the Tanaim and Amoraim, which gets off the ground courtesy of the efforts of the Kerem B'Yavne, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in the year 70 and beyond. So that's an example of Reform Judaism. So we have precedent. That's what he would argue. Alternatively, for the Reformers, they see precedent in the relaxed and less rigorous approach of the Sfaradim and of Italian Jewry. That whereas Ashkenazic Jewry of Central and Eastern Europe, by the 18th century, is very restrictive in its halachic praxis, the Sephardim of Western Europe were much more relaxed in their ways. And when I say Sephardim of Western Europe, I mean specifically Western Europe, not the Middle East. That's a whole other world.
Are you talking about Amsterdam?
So, right, we're going to get to Amsterdam becomes an example of early modern Judaism.
How would you classify the Spanish then?
So there are no Spanish, but there are Spanish who move away and go elsewhere, notably to Amsterdam and to southern France and to London and to the New World. Okay. Gershom Scholem, in the 1940s, made the following claim. He said that Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, and Reform Judaism have their origins in Shabtaut. What is Shabtaut? Sabbatianism. Okay, we discussed Sabbatianism at great length last year when we discussed Jacob Frank, who was a false messiah and a lecherous individual who was a con artist, who basically bamboozled a whole bunch of people into thinking he was either a godly figure or a messianic figure. And he converted to Islam, he converted to Christianity, he did a lot of different things in his life. But the last thing he was an honest Jew. Now how does Shabtaut lead into Reform Judaism? So Jacob Katz, my favorite historian, and in my opinion the greatest historian of 20th century Judaism, he denies Shalom's theory. However, Shalom is right in this respect. Sabbatian controversies hurt the rabbinate. What keeps old line religion afloat? The power of the rabbinate to enforce religious observance on an unwilling public. And by the way, it's an unwilling public in Central Europe by the late 1700s. People are not especially pious anymore. We'll get into why that's the case. But they're not looking for to follow every jot and tittle of the halakha, that the Shulchan Aruch is not guiding their lives. But when the rabbis have very, very absolute power over the kehillah, including the power of the cherem, excommunication, public observance of Jewish law can be enforced even if the private individual doesn't really want to. And that suppresses any possibility of a heterodox movement. Well, what did the Sabbatian controversies do to the power of the rabbinate? It destroyed it. Because the Emden Eibeschitz controversies basically showed rabbis don't agree with each other. This rabbi can say this thing, this rabbi can say that thing. They can say nasty things about each other, accuse each other of heresy, and all sorts of theological crimes. And so in the end, the koach, the strength of Central European rabbinate is in the dumps. It's no longer what it once was. The other factor is Frankism and the all sorts of bizarre behavior associated with Frankism proved that there could be such a thing as antinomian Judaism. Now, in the first century, what is antinomian Judaism called? Christianity. It's called Pauline Christianity. That you don't have to keep the laws anymore. That if you believe alone, that's good enough, and you'll go to heaven. But as for the Shmirat HaMitzvot, you can throw it away because that's no longer the binding covenant. Well, that's Christianity. But for Judaism, the law, the halakha, remain the cornerstone of our religious tradition. Well, if you have a group within Judaism that can sort of on a whim disregard kashrut, fast days, much of the Sabbath law, all sorts of pillars of Judaism, what means that antinomian Judaism is possible. Maybe not as weird as Frankism, but something more socially acceptable without halakha might be able to emerge. Okay.
What is the exact translation of antinomia?
Contrary to the law, the nomos, the law. So, in the late 1700s, in Central Europe, and for that matter in the few communities that existed in Western Europe, there is a decline in religious observance among two social groups. One are the extreme wealthy. The other, the extreme poor. The middle class, if you could say there is such a thing, or just the middle group, remains fairly pious. But the top-ranking people who are interacting with the Gentile leadership, political class, they sort of have to compromise their religious standards. Now, what type of people am I talking about? I didn't use the term, but you should know the term. The court Jew. So the court Jew are a limited number, a small number of people who are advisors or financial backers of the European monarchs, and they are able to cultivate for themselves legal protections that the average Jew doesn't have. All right? And because of their circumstances, have to appear like the nobility, meaning they don't wear the traditional Jewish garb, they don't have the appearance of a Jew, the physiognomy of they'll have, but the attire and the way they groom themselves and comport themselves will be like that of the elite of Gentile society.
How influential were they as far as numbers go?
So, very small, but influential in terms of protecting Jewish interests when they bothered to do so, when they functioned as shtadlanim, and very influential economically in terms of propping up monarchs who have money problems. Okay, but they're moving away from the religious observance of their ancestors. What about the bottom of the heap? Those who are very, very poor have problems of domicile, place of residence. there are very restrictive laws in some of the Central European communities about the number of Jews who can live there. And even if you had a father who had a right of residence, it didn't mean that you had a right of residence, because some communities only allowed one child to marry and build a family in that community, and the others had to move on. And if they couldn't find a cheskata yishuv, a right of residence somewhere, they became like the Luftmenschen, okay, people who live on the air. They have no real place. And those kind of people who have to scrap together a living in any way possible are sometimes not going to allow religious scruples to get in the way of basic subsistence, which means that the kashrus, the Shabbos, might have to go by the boards and just to survive. Also, people who find themselves in that predicament end up violating matters of Ben Adam L'Chavero, that become thieves and they become petty criminals. So the dire economic circumstances of the Jewish underclass, which is created by anti-Semitic legislation to begin with, creates this eventual departure from traditional observance. Okay, so that's what's happening in the 1700s.
Now,
okay, so in Russia, the Jewish community is very, very backward culturally. But it's not a problem. Why? Because so are the Gentiles. And this is a very important concept in modern Jewish history. Jews will acculturate and adopt chukoteihem shel ha'akum, the ways of the heathens, if and only if they internalize the critique that their culture is inferior and that the heathen culture is somehow great and wonderful and superior. But if, by objective assessment, Jewish culture, religious culture is whatever it is, it's our tradition, but putting aside matters of religion, if just the way the Jews comport themselves and conduct their lives is at a fairly low cultural and aesthetic level, but the surrounding Gentiles are just as bad, there's no incentive to adopt their ways. You end up just having mutual antagonism. Jews don't like Gentiles, and Gentiles don't like Jews. And that's the fate of the Jews in the Pale. Okay, it's very different in across the border once you escape the Romanov Empire and get into the Habsburg Empire and the German lands. Okay, so there's erratic and inconsistent departures from religious observance. And when I say erratic and inconsistent, let's try to compare that with America today. In America today, there are very few Jews who are Shomer Shabbos but eat treif. But there are plenty of people who keep kosher but are not technically Shomer Shabbos. And there are plenty of people who are kosher observant, but matters of the mikvah are foreign to them. Okay, there's a hierarchy of observance. Now, it may not be logical according to the standards of Talmudic halacha. Okay, but it's logical to us. We know what it is in America today. Because for the last 100-some-odd years, American Jews have evolved this level of observance. And so this, you know, a group of Jews does this, and this group of Jews does a little bit less, and a little bit less, and a little bit less. There's a noticeable pattern that makes sense to us. But in the 1760s, 1770s, 80s, 90s, even the early 1800s, there's no logical consistency to why Jews would depart from this mitzvah or that. It just whatever came to them on their downward spiral away from full observance. Now, what about the Haskalah? So, last year we discussed Mendelssohn at length, and Mendelssohn is regarded as a hero by many sectors of Jewish society today. But, as I mentioned last year, he would not fit into those sectors of society if he were alive today. The reformers of the mid-20th century like to claim that Mendelssohn was one of their intellectual forebears, except that he wasn't. Mendelssohn was the first modern Orthodox Jew. And Mendelssohn believed in revealed legislation, that the Torah and the law of the Torah is revealed by God and is incumbent upon Jews to observe in total until some other revelation comes to undermine it or take it away. And since such a revelation has never happened, and he didn't anticipate one happening, it's not as though he was a closet Christian, then therefore a Jew must observe the law. His,
that's a pretty safe statement.
It's a very safe statement. What's not so safe is his claim that there are no dogmas in Judaism, and that Judaism is purely a matter of practice, as opposed to peculiar theological beliefs. That's where he drew the line between Judaism and Christianity, that Christianity is a religion of dogma, Judaism is a religion of practice, and we must continue practicing until God tells us otherwise. Okay. But Mendelssohn had no intellectual heirs who continued to believe along those lines. The Maskilim, his successors, who were writers and public intellectuals, they adopted a different approach. And each one...
Which Maskilim knew him personally?
Huh?
Which Maskilim knew him?
Knew him personally?
Or attached themselves to him? I mean, were they a distance?
So most of the famous ones had little to do with him personally. Naftali Herzvesely had little to do with Mendelssohn personally. David Friedlander did, because they both lived in Berlin. We'll get to David Friedlander soon. Isaac Euchel, who was his biographer, knew him personally, but some of the others didn't. They lived elsewhere, lived in another city. Okay, or they post-dated him. They were of a generation later, yeah.
This scenario that you're describing with Mendelssohn, where he's the gadol,
right?
But then there is no heir apparent.
Right.
That is the story over and over again, even in the 20th century. Uh-huh. Some of the most legendary, certainly in the United States, rabbinic leaders and writers who had a foundation of real substance,
right,
did not have anyone to pass it.
Unless they were teachers.
Yeah. Like my Shur Rabbeinu, yeah. It's true. It's a very fair point. Now, let's talk about the Enlightenment a little bit. The French Enlightenment was anti-clerical, anti-religious. They wanted to burn down the churches. And that affected Judaism in France to the extent that it was suppressed in the Reign of Terror. It wasn't such a simple thing to be an observant Jew. But in Germany, the Enlightenment was not anti-religious, and it was not even anti-clerical. It was just anti-dogmatic. That they were believers in natural religion, but if you were a Christian pastor who continued in the traditions of the church, but on matters of belief followed natural religion, you were okay. That was perfectly fine. And the Jews followed suit. Basically, the Maskilic Jews believed in natural religion and got rid of the revealed legislation that Mendelssohn spoke about. So, were they...
What do you mean by natural...
So, it means that divine revelation isn't all that necessary in determining what makes a person a good person. Meaning we can come across what God wants from us without a particular moment in time where a corpus of law is handed down on a mountain. Okay?
That's the state of nature with Hobbes. And the Leviathan. I mean, just because you're not going to go slit my throat at night,
yeah,
it's not right to slit somebody's throat at night.
Yeah.
You don't need God in the
You don't need, right. You don't need God, but that's what God wants. In other words, it's not rejecting God, it's just saying that revelation as such would be superfluous. And therefore, whatever, you know, ritual laws exist in the revelation also would become superfluous and can be done away with. And so the Maskilic successors to Mendelssohn didn't stop to daven mincha at 4:30 on a winter's day, whereas he did. Mitzvot Shimiyot and Mitzvot Sichliot.
Yeah,
but that predates him by 800 years. Sadia Gaon already did that. So, the German Enlightenment was not anti-religious, which means that you can have people who are moving away from old-fashioned religion and are influenced by modern trends of thought, and yet still want to have a religious denomination. Not to declare themselves atheists or agnostics, but rather want to have some organized religion, yet one which is going to differ dramatically from what existed 50 or 100 years previously. Okay. What is the attitude of the Gentile world towards the reform of Judaism? This is going to be an ongoing issue over the next few weeks as we discuss the attitude of the government towards Jewish reform. Basically, it comes down to three points. The radical, extreme, and you could argue anti-Semitic point of view about the reform of Judaism is that not only must Jews change their social and economic profile and get rid of their ghetto habits and become like good European citizens, but they also must change their religion. They must change their religion and make it more appropriate for a modern European setting, as opposed to the law of Moses in the Torah, which is more appropriate for 3rd century BCE land of Israel. That the laws of the Bible were intended for the polity of Israel in ancient times, a national existence, and were not intended to be carried out in 1799 Berlin. Okay, so not only do Jews have to stop being filthy moneylenders, that their social and economic profile has to change, they have to become artisans and agriculturalists, they have to be like everybody else, not just involved in finance, but they have to change their religion and develop a high church of Judaism, effectively, just like the Protestant church of northern Germany. And if they don't do this, what should happen? They should not be emancipated. That's a chutzpah. To say the Jews should not be emancipated unless they first change their social and economic profile and their religion, and yet there were those who said that. Of course, no Jew would ever say this. Not even the leaders of the Reform movement in the next generation would ever say such a thing. Okay, yeah.
But the jury, did they let them?
So yes, slowly. Economic and social over time, over the span of about 100 years between 1770 and 1870, when you finally have full emancipation of German Jews, and religiously, we'll learn about it over the next few weeks.
And how is this different from Martin Luther, who expected the Jew to welcome his Christianity with open arms by rejecting their Judaism? It sounds like
the difference is that he expected them to convert, you know, to have a shmad, whereas this expectation is just that old Talmudic Judaism will give way to something a little bit more decorous and aesthetically pleasing. But it could still be called Judaism. The Jews wouldn't need to convert.
Isn't Napoleon the same thing, Napoleon Code?
So we're going to discuss in a few minutes what he tried to do with the Assembly of Notables and the Paris Sanhedrin, where he's moving along those lines. Now, that's one extreme point of view. The other point of view is that Jews should change their economic and social profile, and maybe even their religious profile, but that their emancipation should not be talui, dependent upon those things happening. In other words, by right of being human beings, our ancestors should have been given their emancipation, full political equality as citizens of the modern European state, and along the way, what's going to inevitably happen, that the Jews will not look like the shtetl Jews of 300 years ago, they'll look like modern European citizens. That it'll take a generation or two, but they'll change their economic ways and even their religious ways. So the Reform ideologues basically all adopted this point of view. Now the third point of view is emancipation should happen no matter what because it's a matter of human dignity, and economic and social integration may very well happen, but who's to say any religious reformation will happen? Maybe the religion is the religion of God, of Moses on Mount Sinai, and we'll keep every last bit of it until Messianic times. And whose opinion is that? Samson Raphael Hirsch, basically. That's the neo-Orthodox point of view. That even if there's cultural integration, there need not be a change in religion. All right. So, in the late 1700s, you have a few public intellectuals, characters. Yeah, any question?
Wasn't there a basic distrust of the Talmudical Jew as opposed to the biblical Jew?
Oh, sure. So, yeah. That the biblical Jew was seen as a Mosaist who had moral scruples, whereas the Talmudic Jew was looking to cheat you at every turn and said Kol Nidre on Yom Kippur just so he could lie.
No, I think also it was the abstract thinking, the discourse, the...
Correct, the pill pool.
The pill pool. That made them nuts. And they were more literally inclined. The Bible says this. Okay, the Bible says this. But then the Talmud do so many...
So since roughly the year 1700, when Eisenmenger put out his screed against the Talmud, Western intellectuals who had an axe to grind with Judaism could cite passages, not that they read the original Aramaic, but they could cite passages in the German that say all sorts of things that we really don't want to read in the Talmud, but that they're there. And if you take them out of context, or sometimes even in context, they're not very pleasant. And from a Gentile point of view, could lead you to say that Talmudic Judaism is a sinister religion. And plenty of people made that claim, yes. Okay, so we have these public intellectuals who, some of them are rabbis, and they say things and do things that are a departure from the norm. For example, first one is Saul Berlin. Now, Saul Berlin was the son of Herschel Levin. Herschel Levin was the chief rabbi of London, and for a time the chief rabbi of Berlin. That's why his son is called Saul Berlin. Saul Berlin was briefly the rabbi of Frankfurt on the Oder, and then went to Italy, and then came back to Germany and fought with Raphael Cohn, who was the chief rabbi of Hamburg-Altona, and eventually dies in London in 1794, a penniless apostate at the age of 54. But his claim to fame is that he wrote the Besamim Rosh. What do you know about the Besamim Rosh? Anything? The name of that sefer ring a bell? Besamim Rosh? Who's the Rosh? Rabbeinu Asher. When did Rabbeinu Asher live? Middle Ages. He died in 1324, give or take a few years. Okay, he was a great codifier, the Rosh. He's one of the three heavyweights of the Rishonim. Who are the three heavyweights of the Rishonim? The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. And what does the Shulchan Aruch do? It decides the halacha on the basis of those three heavyweights. So the Rosh is a major figure. And the Besamim Rosh was supposedly a manuscript that he found in Italy with the responsa of the Rosh that had been unknown for 400 years. And he published it. But it turned out it was a forgery. He wrote it himself. Why did he do it? Because he wanted to offer leniencies, radical leniencies within the halakha, and no one would listen to him because he was some marginal figure, or about to be a very marginal figure. But if he says that I found a manuscript and the Rabbeinu Asher wrote this in the year 1300, all of a sudden has great weight. Well, was it exposed? It was exposed right away. But not everyone believed it was a forgery. And even into the 20th century, there were some gedolim in Eretz Yisrael who thought that the Besamim Rosh was a real sefer and were quoted in halakhic literature. Why do I mention this? Just to show you that the son of the chief rabbi of London or the chief rabbi of Berlin could become himself a rabbinical figure, yet have a break from tradition and try to use the tradition itself to undermine the tradition, to have a bogus sefer to undermine the halakha. That's the environment we're in right now, in the late 1700s. I wouldn't say he was a mishuma that he converted to Christianity, but he rejected Judaism. Walked away from it. Okay, another example. Solomon Maimon. Solomon Maimon is famous for writing an autobiography in which he discusses Hasidism, which was brand new in Eastern Europe at that time. He was born in 1753 and died in 1800. He was an Eastern European Jew who was unimpressed by Hasidism and thought that the Rebbes were charlatans and that they were fooling their followers with all sorts of hocus pocus. I'm reminded of a story, I won't say where it happened, but it's in the New York metro area, of a certain Rebbe who would always know what his parishioners would be coming to speak to him about. Why? Because he had cameras in the lobby with audio. This was in the 1980s, and he would send out the shamus to ask an introductory question to the person, and then not have the shamus walk into the office, but have the person walk into the office, and he'd say, "Oh, I know why you're here." And so the 1790s version of that was in Solomon Maimon's autobiography. Okay, so he came to Central Europe, to Berlin, to study philosophy, and he became one of the greatest interpreters of Kant, Immanuel Kant, and it was in the circle that was associated with Mendelssohn after Mendelssohn's death. But he basically had the following point. He said, rebellion against Judaism is all or nothing. You're either all in or all out. And there's no possibility of reform. Reform Judaism cannot exist. Either you're a rabbinical Jew of the old line variety, or you're not a Jew. And what was his choice? To be not a Jew. Doesn't mean he converted to Christianity. A lot of these folks were hesitant to take baptism because they had objection to the notion of Christianity. Just like they didn't like doctrinal Judaism, they didn't like doctrinal Christianity. They wanted something other, which was unavailable to them. Okay, another character was Lazarus ben David. Lazarus ben David said you could reject all the ritual laws of Judaism, but still remain a Jew. That Judaism is compatible with natural religion and devoid of ceremony.
Sounds Quaker.
Sounds a little Quaker. Also sounds like the Democratic, the Jewish wing of the Democratic Party. It was a joke they used to say. It was a Democratic Party with holidays. But in other words, you could have your Jewish identity, but without much Judaism. That was his point of view. Another character was Saul Asher, who died in 1822. And he called for a reformation of Judaism as a religion. And what he did was to say, let's give up the distinct ways of life and our prejudices, key point, the prejudices, the anti-Gentile prejudices, in order to achieve emancipation. And he contradicted Mendelssohn in saying that Judaism is primarily a matter of belief. What are the beliefs of Judaism? The Maimonidean 13 principles. The Maimonidean 13 principles are Judaism. And as for mitzvah observance, not so important. So if you believe like a Jew, you're a good Jew. The fact that you don't observe, not so important. Okay. So, is there any progress being made? You have these thinkers who are saying things, but what's actually happening? Let's finally get to changes in Jewish life. The earliest changes happen not in the synagogue, but in the educational institutions. Now, why is that the case? Because most people didn't go to school. Most people were privately educated. If you were wealthy, you had a fancy tutor. Parents paid a lot of money. You learned Greek and Latin. You learned math. Maybe you learned a little Judaism, too, if your family was religious. And you learned these subjects privately. If you were poor, you were lucky to learn a trade. But as time went on, and as education became more of a standard in Europe for children of all religious stripes, Jews also wanted to educate their children in a school setting. So the wealthy continued to have private tutoring, but the poor needed a philanthropic organization to educate their kids. And such organizations were established in many Central European cities. So here you had maskilim being do-gooders running schools for the children of the poor. And what kind of subjects are the maskilim going to teach in a school for the Jewish poor? What do you think they're going to teach them? Maskilim. Not Mendelssohnian maskilim. What are they going to teach the Jewish poor?
Secular,
of course. Not much religion. And whatever religion they're going to learn will be the Bible, not the Talmud. Why? Because the Bible is good. And the Talmud, not so good. But mostly secular.
What about the gymnasium?
Okay, so the gymnasia is really like an Eastern European phenomenon. And is mostly secular schools, like Yiddishist or Russian type schools. That's Eastern, yeah. But in Frankfurt, in Berlin, in Magdeburg, in a bunch of Central European cities, you have a philanthropic school for the poor run by maskilim. What do? There, they teach the Bible, okay, and they're going to use translations of the Bible. Which translation? Possibly Mendelssohn's translation, or possibly even an outright German language with German Latin characters. But they're also going to daven. Why? Because they're still Jewish. And Jews daven. Even if you're not so religious, you daven. What kind of davening is it going to be? Is it going to be the full thing from Berachos HaShachar to Shir Shel Yom? No. That's too much. It's going to be a short service. And what language is that service going to be? Well, a little bit of abyssal Hebrew, but mostly the vernacular, which for those parts of the world is going to be German. So they're going to write an Andacht book, a book of petitions, a book of prayers. Not a sitter. It's not going to be a full translation of the traditional sitter, but it's going to be a book of prayers that will have translations of some traditional prayer, but also the composition of some new things that seem appropriate for the time, and German hymns. Okay, and when is this service going to happen? Well, it could happen on Shabbos. Or it could happen on a Sunday. Or it could happen on a Tuesday. It could happen any day of the week. It's a devotional service that is related to, but not exactly the same as, traditional tefillah. Okay. Now you could see where this is headed. That where, in the beginning, it's in a school for children, but it's an aesthetically pleasing devotional service. Who's also going to like it? The adults, the parents. And that will eventually lead to the establishment of the Reformed temples, the earliest Reformed temples. Okay. So,
question?
Yeah.
The clientele was primarily poor?
In the beginning, yes.
So I think all these secular topics would be good for learning to make a living.
Correct. It'd help get the people out of poverty.
If it were a shtetl type school, they would be stuck in a shtetl type life.
That's correct. Okay. Now, the first congregation, not school for children, not the youth department, but the first adult shul, to move in the direction of a more decorous service was in Amsterdam, in the Batavian Republic. And what's the Batavian Republic? So after the French conquest of certain parts of Western Europe, the political landscape changed. And so there was a move in the direction of throwing out the old and bringing in the new. So in 1795, you have the establishment of, among the Ashkenazic Jews, Congregation Adas Yeshurun, or Adath Yeshurun. And it was moderate reform in the sense that there was a vernacular sermon, which was a brand new idea. There was the elimination of piyutim that nobody understood. Okay, because nobody understood them. Even today, who understands it?
Like here.
Okay, so but they removed them.
Yeah.
And other aesthetic changes in the layout of the synagogue. Okay, so it's a nice service. That's a slight departure from what was, but otherwise is compliant with the halakha. But that's only in Amsterdam. Why? Because there's more freedom there.
Why traditionally was Amsterdam?
Okay, so the answer is because the Sephardim, who were the dominant group in Amsterdam, were ex-Maranos who had a history of non-traditional belief. You know, a character like Spinoza doesn't come out of the air. He's there for a reason, because that environment, the kind of people that they were not steeped in 1,000 years of rabbinism, of devotion to Talmudic Judaism. Their return to Judaism was recent and arguably incomplete, if you want to take a hyper-Orthodox point of view. The Ashkenazim who moved there also were influenced by the culture, the more advanced culture, and the relaxed ways of the Sephardim. And so they broke away from the Sephardim to establish their own shul, because they wanted to have their own minhagim and their own ways, but to do it in a manner which might not be so satisfactory to the people who lived further east. Yeah. Well, because they knew the wider world. The Jews of Amsterdam were not very parochial like the Jews of further inland, who only knew their particular community and nothing else. The Jews of Amsterdam are aware that there's a wider world out there.
Yeah.
Right, and any territory that was controlled by them was also similarly a free area until they lose to the Portuguese or the Spanish. Okay, so in France, there is very little reason to advance reform of the religion after the year 1791 for a simple reason. Emancipation happened in a snap of a finger. Unlike elsewhere in Europe, where emancipation takes decades and decades of lobbying and hard-fought efforts of politicking. In France, with the revolution, the Sephardic Jews of the southern France, of Bordeaux and Bayonne, were emancipated in 1790, and the Jews, the Ashkenazic Jews of Alsace-Lorraine, were emancipated in 1791 by a decision of the legislature. And there were no strings attached. In other words, it wasn't a deal like you have to change your religious ways or your cultural ways in order for you to get this citizenship. It's just granted. You are now citizens of France. So without that political angle, religion just kind of stagnates. In any event, the Jews of southern France were not all especially religious. They were ex-Maranos who never fully re-embraced Talmudic Judaism. The Jews of northeastern France...
What made them leave Christianity?
Well, because ethnically, they remained Jewish. They did not intermarry to any significant extent. And so as a matter of Jewish pride, if you can reassert your Jewish identity, you would like to. But it doesn't mean you're especially frum.
Or learned,
right. Now, the Jews of northeastern France, who were Ashkenazim, were basically Germanic-type Jews, they were very, very traditional and were not interested in any reforms of religious practice. They wanted to just observe their rites and ceremonies as they always had. Okay, but in 1806, something changed. Napoleon got complaints that the Jews are acting too Jewish. What does that mean? I don't mean they're wearing tefillin all the way till Mincha time. No, I mean that they are taking usury from the Gentiles, and they are not treating the Gentile neighbors as brethren, but rather there's this cultural gap between Jew and Gentile. It's an unbridgeable divide, and they're not our kinsmen. And the whole point of the revolution and the Napoleonic way was that all Frenchmen should be brothers and fighting the same good fight. And if the Jews retain this other status about them, that's not good. And Napoleon wants answers. And so he convenes an assembly of notables in 1806 and asks them a whole bunch of questions, about 12 questions. We won't go through all of them, but the gist of it is, do you consider the Frenchmen your brethren or not? Is it permissible to take usury from a Jew? Is it permissible to take usury from a Gentile? Is it permissible for a Jew to marry a Christian? Whether a Jewess marrying a Christian man or a Jew marrying a Christian woman? Is it permissible for Jews to have more than one wife? Is it permissible for Jews to engage in marriage or divorce outside the bounds of state law? The other questions were about the power of the rabbis. Who picks the rabbis? What kind of police power do they have? What kind of judicial power do they have? So, of course, the assembly wants to give answers that don't annoy the king. Some of the answers, if they could speak truthfully, would not be so satisfactory. So they have to fudge the answers. So what do they say? Well, the brethren part, the kinsmen part, was very simple. Oh, of course, the Frenchman, Jew, or Gentile, we're brothers, absolutely. That's easy to get away with, because there's no halachic issue in play there, or at least there isn't any direct one. About usury, they said Jews cannot charge usury to anyone. Is that true?
No.
So no, it's not. But it depends how you define usury. We could have like Clintonian grammar here. Usury is defined as exorbitant interest as opposed to regular interest. So you could say that Jews shouldn't charge exorbitant interest to anyone. But as for a modicum of interest, yeah, we can't charge Jews, but you can charge it to the goyim. That they didn't say. They said usury, oh, we can't do usury. What about the... Oh, sure, yeah. So Napoleon's no dummy. He knows in the Bible it says your brother, and it says
l'nachri tashich, but achicha lo tashich. The Christian population.
Yeah.
Were they as observant about the Christian laws of usury?
Yes, they were.
Okay, so if they were in the Middle Ages, they had to rely on the Jews.
Absolutely.
To charge.
There's a long history of Jews being a necessary economic factor in nascent capitalism.
And then they beheaded the Jews.
Of course, yeah.
So there was no difference in the gameplay in the beginning of the 19th century. Then.
Not much, no.
So why was it an issue?
Because the in Eastern France, the Gentiles were becoming indebted and impoverished in the cattle trade and in the grain trade to Jewish middlemen who somehow cornered the market and were able to pile up more and more deals in which the Gentile was the debtor and the Jew was the creditor, and the Gentile neighbor couldn't escape this dire economic strait, and so they complained to the authorities in Paris. You know, the Jews are ruining us.
This is still the beginning of the 19th century.
This is 1805, 1806. Okay, and the Jews benefited as war profiteers because the ongoing Napoleonic Wars. The Jews knew how to handle that very well. All right. So the other answers. What about intermarriage? Can a Jew marry a Christian? So they fudged the answer here. They said, if a Jew marries a Christian within the laws of the state, then it's binding. Except It cannot be solemnized in a religious ceremony. How do you like that answer?
That's okay.
I mean, it's a factual answer. We're not going to do Mesidah Kiddushin, but if they go to City Hall and get married and the law of the land says it's legal, who are we to argue? That's effectively the answer.
It's the same thing as City Hall here.
Yeah.
It's really a fudge.
It is a fudge, but listen, they got to keep Napoleon happy. What about the power of the rabbis? So they said that the rabbis do not have any police or juridical power if the state does not confer it upon them, and whatever compliance they get from their constituents is all voluntary.
False.
Well, it's not so false anymore, because as Jewish society changes, the rabbis really will lose any serious police power. Especially if we're not dealing with a close-knit, you know, insular community. I mean, yeah, in a Hasidic environment where they don't know the outside world, if the Rebbe says something, you get bumped off if you don't follow it. But in France in 1806, that wasn't going to happen.
So there's no
harem. No, harem was done away with. Yes.
Even today, all Jews, as others, have civil ceremonies.
Right.
And if you want to have a Jewish ceremony, that's your private business.
Yeah, yeah.
The rabbis do not officiate at the pleasure of the state as they do in the United States.
Right. So, now the last question was, are there any occupations that a Jew is forbidden by his religion to engage in?
Priest.
No, well, they weren't talking about that. Now, the reason for that question was because the Jews were supposed to change their economic profile in this emancipatory period, to go from being moneylenders and middlemen and peddlers to being like everyone else who might engage in any number of crafts or occupations. And so the answer, the legitimate answer is, we're not prevented from engaging in any occupation. And they had to say that answer lest Napoleon be angry. Okay, so these answers were solidified by the Sanhedrin. Now, the Sanhedrin? What do you mean the Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin hasn't existed since the days of the Mishnah. Answer is, Napoleon convened the Sanhedrin in February of 1807 in Paris, the Paris Sanhedrin. There were 70 members. It was with the pomp and circumstance. It was a show, a big, big show, where all 70 members, rabbis, no, but half of them were. And they ratified these conclusions. How does this have to do with...
Napoleon wanted good answers.
Okay.
Napoleon, yeah. Napoleon was a mensch.
I don't know if he was a mensch. You could call him a bully. That he's insisting upon certain things. All right. Okay. So it was a combination of both. His government ministers invited the original Assembly of Notables, and the Assembly of Notables then invited more people to participate in the Sanhedrin. Okay. What does any of this have to do with the reform of Judaism? The answer is this. Where Napoleon's armies were to advance, you have an opportunity for emancipation and for a new style of Judaism without the authority, the firm authority of the old line rabbis. Moreover, Napoleon likes official religion. He had a concordat with the Vatican in 1801. He likes to make deals whereby there's an established religious hierarchy. So he'll create one.
As of today.
Friends, so the consistory...
The rabbis paid by the state.
Rabbis paid by the state, exactly. So, who's the rabbi now? Corsia? Chaim Corsia is the rabbi?
Yeah.
So establishing a consistory of government employees to run the Jewish religion means that whoever runs this religion is going to create a new style of religion. And it isn't going to be the old line variety.
Like a rabbanut.
Like a rabbanut, but not a Haredi rabbanut. Okay. So.
Like a rabbanut.
Yes.
180 degrees.
Maybe. So who's in charge? Well, in Westphalia, the kingdom of Westphalia, the king is not Napoleon Bonaparte, but Jerome Bonaparte, his brother. He propped up his like doofus brother Jerome to be the king in this Westphalian kingdom, over the border in the Germanic lands. And Jerome was a nobody from nothing, but he established the consistory, and who is the head of the consistory? Israel Jacobson. Jacobson was a very wealthy Jew, not an extremely learned Jew, whether in secular or Judaic studies, but he was devoted to the cause of Judaism. And what does he want? He wants not reforms, but improvements in the public worship. So he wants the rabbi to be a pastoral clergyman and a sermonizer, not a halachist who checks the kashrus of chickens. So he's going to create a new style, but he needs compliance by the congregations in his jurisdiction. So what are some of the improvements that he's looking for? Well, I'll rattle them off. Number one, get rid of Av HaRachamim. Why? Because it's pretty vicious. I mean, what do we say in Av HaRachamim? That our enemies get their comeuppance in a really bloody way. Right, but if we're now the kinsmen, the brothers of our French or German fellow citizens, we can no longer hope for nekama, vengeance. Okay, next thing, Tfilah LaMedina, the prayer for the government. Now, truth be told, it had been said for many, many years even before that. It goes back to the Mishnah and Avos of Chanina Skana Kohanim, who said, that if you don't pray for the government, man is going to swallow his fellow alive. And Yirmiyahu says, you pray for the land in which I send you. But now make the prayer for the Medina a very serious part of the davening, and say it in the vernacular. Also, get rid of piyutim that people don't understand. Also, a sermon. Now, not just that the sermon is going to be in the vernacular, because it had to be since they didn't speak Hebrew, but that there is even a sermon at all. When did the rabbi speak in pre-modern times? Shabbos Shuva, Shabbos Agadol. And we're going to see that in the first half of the 1800s, there's a big issue for rabbis who were hired decades earlier, who are older and later in their career, but the community is changing, and they want the rabbi to function as a modern-day clergyman. These rabbis might refuse to give drushes on a regular basis, and only give the old-style one twice a year, which leads to what? Hiring an assistant rabbi. And in 3 weeks from now, we'll discuss the most famous machlokas about the hiring of an assistant rabbi, Abraham Geiger in Breslau. Okay. Next point. No superstition. So any custom, even if it's a popular one people like, and is benign, doesn't really harm anyone, but it's based upon a superstition, get rid of it. Such as the throwing of rice or the swinging of chickens. I mean, a lot of life cycle customs. Okay, the wedding should be in the shul, not outdoors. Why? Because weddings are in a house of worship. In Western Europe, where is a wedding held? In the church. So therefore, the wedding should be in the shul. Whatever halachic objections there are to that, forget. Don't worry about it. Wedding in the shul. Okay, less Misha Berach. Why? Because what happens during the Misha Berach?
You talk,
or you go to the Kiddush Club. So less Misha Berach, because it ruins the decorum of the synagogue. No Malkus. What's Malkus? Erev Yom Kippur, they would give flagellation. They'd corporal punishment. I mean, not like in the days of the Talmud, 39 times, you know, front and back, but they would give Erev Yom Kippur a little corporal punishment.
Was that a Christian origin? Because the Hirsher was...
Okay, so in the days of the Hasidic Ashkenaz, all sorts of self-mortification were practiced. Now, it wasn't just the Jews. The Goyim did it too. That fell out of style because people don't like mortification and flagellation, but some, you know, token effort of it was kept on Erev Yom Kippur in some communities. All right? Less hakafot. Now, not just on Simchas Torah, where it gets a little wild, but even Sukkot's time, with the lulav and esrog, they didn't really like that. They didn't think it was decorous. More chazanut. Why more chazanut? Because chazanut, of the Western variety, not necessarily like the old Ashkenazi Nusach, but Chazanut, choral music is similar to the church. Okay? No bar mitzvah boy doing the laning. Why? Because he fouls it up. We want professionalism. It's interesting.
But you see that in shuls now.
Yeah?
You see that like in Passaic. Show Yosha.
Be'ever Hanar.
No, they don't.
But that's not because the kid can't read properly. It's for a different reason. The same way as in the yeshiva circle, there are many synagogues where they disallow the B'nai Mitzvah to read Torah Shul.
Yeah.
not because they can't read. It's just
well, there are other reasons. There are technical reasons, other factors. Technical factors. You don't know if he's an adult. All right. Okay. So these reforms did not lead to a major controversy in the beginning. Jacobson led a committee of six people, three rabbis and three laymen, to implement these changes in the Westphalian consistory in all the congregations. But the congregations were reluctant to comply. But it didn't cause major fights until they did the following. They allowed kitnios on Pesach. Okay, so why did they allow kitnios on Pesach? Aside from the fact that it's only an Ashkenazic custom and not a universal one, and that Sephardim allow it, and the reformers tend to have a penchant for Sephardic practices, they claim the issue was that on Pesach, Jewish soldiers conscripted into the Napoleonic armies would have a very limited supply of matzah. And if you don't want them to eat bread, what are they going to eat? You have to allow kitnios for them not to starve and yet still comply with basic halakha. That was the argument that was set forth by Menachem Mendel Steinhardt, who was the leading rabbi in the consistory. And he was a fairly major halachist. He was no slouch.
Wouldn't that hold today, too?
Huh?
Wouldn't that hold today, too?
Yeah, in World War II, if you were fighting in the Battle of whatever, you would eat kidneys.
With the
okay. Yeah. Okay. So where are these changes first going to take place? The consistory had a school. Remember, the schools were the first places to do the changes, not the established synagogues. It was a school in Kassel, and they had a Sabbath Vesper service, which is basically, after the main synagogue service was over in the schoolhouse, they'd have like a half hour or an hour long prayer devotional exercise. The confirmation replaced the bar mitzvah, and the confirmation, unlike the bar mitzvah, which was liturgical, the confirmation was question and answer. It was a confession of faith. The adult, the teacher, would ask a question, and the disciple, the 13-year-old boy, was expected to give an answer that is consistent with the teachings of Judaism. Okay. Not yet. Later it would be changed to 15 and 16, but in the beginning it was still 13.
Okay. These changes
don't look so crazy. Right?
I think our next rabbi should adopt
it. Yeah.
Did they do anything with the one-day Yom Kippur?
Oh, we're going to spend a whole session on the abolition of the second day Yom Kippur. Come back after Simchas Torah.
We'll eliminate the second day.
Well, no, there'll be two issues that we'll discuss. We'll spend a whole session just on one halakhic issue. Bris Milah, those who wanted to do away with Bris Milah, and this do away with the second day of Yom Tov. That in late October we'll handle those issues. Okay.
That's after Yom Tov.
All right. I don't want anyone to get any ideas, you know. So now the Seisson Temple was built in 1810. So Jacobson put up the money. He was a wealthy man, and his base of operations was in Seisson. And he changed the architecture of the synagogue. So now we're getting to other changes that are more familiar to you if you've ever been to a Reform shul. The Amud is no longer in the middle of the room, but rather at the front and facing forward. Facing towards the congregation, not facing towards the Aron Kodesh. Why? Because the clergy are conducting a service on behalf of a passive a synagogue audience that is sitting in the pews, which is not a good thing, by the way, but was regarded as a positive innovation by the people at the time who liked it. Okay, separate seating, because even in the churches there was separate seating, but the balcony has no partition, so therefore the women in the women's section are exposed to the view of the men, and they can see the service down below. There's no lattice work, there's nothing blocking their view. So that already is getting in the direction of trouble for the early reformers. They're going
to
have.
That's
an ongoing debate that was fought vigorously by Rav Moshe Feinstein and the others in the mid 20th century. But for 1810 Germany, this was a noticeable departure from the existing synagogue architecture. Separate seating, but no machitza.
If you see pictures of Leo Beck in the 30s with his congregation,
right.
One side was men,
one side is women. With nothing in between, yeah. Okay. So the other thing is, there were Latin inscriptions inside the building. What's in a shul? We're in a shul right now. What does it say? It says, Moshe Emes v'Toroso Emes. Moses is true, his Torah is true. And it's in Hebrew letters. And underneath, donated by so-and-so. But in Hebrew letters. Is there anything on the wall here that says in the English language, on the Aron? I don't see anything. In Europe of the early 1800s, to have Latin inscriptions or Roman letter inscriptions in a shul, that's unheard of.
Wait, Latin or Roman letter?
Latin language, but Romanic characters. So this is unheard of. And in points further east, where they regarded the Gentile alphabet as inherently treif, this would be making a disgrace of the shul, you know, Chilul Hashem. Okay, the other thing is there was an organ. And we're going to have to discuss the matter of the organ. The next 2 weeks we'll spend on the organ a long time. The other is the raised pulpit. Okay, in a shul, in modern day shuls, the rabbi gives a sermon. Is he on the same ground level as everybody else? No. For reasons of convenience and for projecting the voice, the pulpit for the sermon is raised. But there never was such a thing in the European synagogues before modern times. Why? Because who gave sermons? It wasn't part of a synagogue life, really. All right, so the raised platform was a major innovation.
When you say raised platform, because I seem
on
to
the
remember...
Beamer.
Oh, because yeah. I seem to remember that there would be a staircase...
Yeah.
For the clergymen to go ahead and to officiate from there.
Yes, but that's in the last 200 years. That's not, you know, in antiquity. Okay.
You had that in synagogues. They used to be churches.
Right.
I know that on the 6th Street Synagogue in the East Village.
There's a spiral staircase to go up to the...
spiral staircase yeah. up to the lectern where
right.
the rabbi speaks. That was from the church.
Yeah, yeah.
That's okay. Where the masks are today.
Right, the Rebbe goes up the staircase.
The high synagogue
yeah. got it from the Jews.
Yeah, yeah. But most of the cathedral synagogues that were built in Europe, whether central, even East Central Europe, in the mid-19th century to late 19th century, had that innovation because it was very helpful. It served a purpose.
You see the same thing, you know, in the Arishul and all that.
Okay, it was unknown to the Europeans, yeah.
You ever seen the Reform synagogue in Charleston? In Savannah?
Savannah, I haven't been. Charleston, okay. Yeah.
Savannah, it, you think you go up, it looks like a church, and it's shaped with a cross.
Oh, go out.
Yeah, and that's because the architect was a Christian,
exactly.
And he designed it based on the church.
Yeah. Yes,
exactly. So that was intentional.
Intentional.
Yes. But that was an Orthodox next. Synagogue originally.
Okay. Let's just two more points I wanted to make before we stop. Now, at the opening ceremony of the Sisson Temple, there was a very beautiful service in which Jacobson gave a speech, a long one at that. People complained it was a little too long. But Gentiles attended the service. Now, that is something that is quite shocking to the Jew of the early 1800s, because who goes to a synagogue? Only Jews. When was the last time a Gentile came into the synagogue? When Christian preachers forcibly made their way into the shul to proselytize Jews in medieval times. Or interfere with liturgical activities if they violated the local ordinance. But for a Gentile to enter the synagogue, just as an observer, a friendly observer, without any intention of disrupting, that's a major thing. It hasn't happened yet. Okay.
Did the churches allow the Jews to come in?
The churches will welcome Jews, but with the expectation that there's going to be baptism to follow. Okay. Now, this. So the Kingdom of Westphalia was an exception to the rule because it was a progressive on that front, in that it wasn't forcing Christianity and the dominance of Christianity on religious minorities. But all this comes to a halt very quickly. Why? Because Napoleon loses. All right. Even before the Battle of Waterloo, he's already falling back. All right. And the Kingdom of Westphalia ceases to exist in September of 1813. And together with that, the Westphalian consistory. So the attempt by Israel Jacobson to force aesthetic reforms and reforms of dubious halachic validity on traditional communities ended up being unsuccessful. Number one, because the communities in part rejected it, and number two, because his power was taken away when the kingdom was no longer. Okay, what that taught him and taught everyone else who was like-minded was that you were not going to be able to use the government to impose religious reform on unsuspecting and unwilling traditional Jews. But rather, if the reform movement is going to have any success, it will have to be because like-minded people gathered together, okay, outside of the context of formal religion, informally, on a volitional basis, and establish something that is to their liking. So next week, we will discuss the Berlin Reform Synagogue of 1815, which is not imposed by the government, but rather was just a group of people who felt this was the way we want to conduct Judaism. And we'll discuss at length the polemic literature, the halachic literature, to defend all of their innovations. And the week after that, we'll discuss the Orthodox response condemning all those innovations. Okay, see you next time.